Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for April 14th, 2017. You're hearing Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20 in a recording by Mitsuko Uchida with the Cleveland Orchestra. It's one of the pieces on the program during our live Boston Symphony broadcast this Saturday at 8 p.m., led by Andres Nelsons. Also on that program is Bruckner's Sixth Symphony, and you'll hear Andres Nelsons talk about both pieces on this podcast. And he'll also have a few thoughts about next week's program, which includes another Mozart concerto, this time with pianist Radu Lupu, and Mozart's Requiem. Also on the podcast this week is Martin Perlman, the founder and conductor of Boston Baroque, talking with my colleague Alan McClellan about Handel's opera Agrippina. Boston Baroque's performance of that piece is what you'll hear on the radio this Sunday night at 7 p.m. on WCRB in concert. Earlier this week, I went to Symphony Hall to talk with Andres Nelsons about the concerts he's conducting between now and the end of the BSO's current season. And you'll hear the different parts of that conversation through the course of the next few podcasts. For this week, the topic was Mozart and Bruckner, and particularly the two piano concertos the orchestra is playing this week and next, which happen to be the only two minor key piano concertos Mozart wrote. And this conversation needs a bit of a setup because of how it begins. Normally, these interviews take place in the conductor's green room, just up the stairs from the stage door. It's a room that's right on the corner of the building, which is why if you listen to enough of these podcasts, you'll eventually hear sirens and buses and cars honking their horns at the corner of Westland and Massachusetts Avenues. It's a minor problem that I don't really mind too much, but this week a high school band on tour from Wisconsin was setting up for a rehearsal on the stage of Symphony Hall. And when I walked in, my mind immediately flashed back to the last time I tried to interview Andres with a band rehearsing in the hall. I had just asked a question about one of the most ethereal, beautiful, heart-wrenching pieces in the repertoire, Alban Berg's Violin Concerto, when the Notre Dame fight song kicked off in the hall. Kind of ruined the moment, so we ended up moving to a different location and all was well with that. But to avoid something similar this week, Andres and I went to the chorus rehearsal room in the basement of Symphony Hall. I set up a quiet sign in the hallway, which, as you'll hear, didn't do too much good at one point, but whatever. Anyway, as we were settling in, I mentioned to Andres that I saw that his wife, Christina Opelijs, who's an international opera star, had done a video at the Baden-Baden Festival with Sarah Willis from the Berlin Philharmonic. Sarah produces an incredible amount of very fun videos with other members of her orchestra and pretty often with guest artists. I had just hit the record button to start getting the right levels, and what Andres was saying immediately seemed pretty relevant to how he looks at his job.
Maybe I was more, when I was a small, very, very, very young guy, I thought maybe it's more, you know, classical music. Yeah, maybe it's very serious. But our task is, firstly, it's serious. It's about life. Life is as serious and as funny as it can be, and also the music. And I think our task is really to move and to touch as many people as we can. It's not just to think, okay, we need to perform it in a great quality, which is, without that, we can't even start. But if we know that we don't touch people and we don't do enough, spreading the information, the spreading the excitement about music, you know, saying, oh, it's great. I think it's a mission of conductor and a mission of musicians as well. Maybe I understand more than earlier. And of course, you have the example of Bernstein, who was, you know, he was a missionary as well. I mean, he was of course a genius person. So that's we have no chance. But but I think generally, you know, yeah. I think. Sorry, I'm just analyzing.
I love hearing that kind of stuff, and I think you're right that Sarah Willis knows exactly what's going on with all of that. She knows exactly what's needed, you know, to connect with people.
To connect is very important.
It's really cool that she brought in Christina to do one of her videos because I think that's, you know, anything that brings an artist like that, like Christina, into the proximity where somebody can kind of relate to them is great, because so often we hear someone like Christina or we watch the BSO and it's easy to build distance because mm-hmm. we don't feel, normal people don't mm-hmm. feel like we can do that, mm-hmm. you know? And so there ends up being sort of an abstract mm-hmm. quality. But mm-hmm. when Sarah does those videos, or when mm-hmm. Christina does the kind of thing that she does, it brings them to us.
Absolutely. That's I think it's a mission too.
Yeah. But you do that well too. So.
I'm trying to. I just understand for myself they should be able to communicate, and that's without that, nothing really.
Yeah.
Works.
Yeah. Oh. The sign doesn't seem to be doing much good. Well, hey, listen, let's talk about the first couple of concerts that you're doing on this stay in Boston, and especially talking about artists who know how to connect with people. Mitsuko Uchida is one of the soloists that you have for a Mozart piano concerto. As we were walking down here, I guess the phrase I used is that she owns this music.
Yeah,
it's so absolutely. Clear that she's so in touch with this music. And then there's Radu Lupu the following week. So let's talk first about these two concertos. Was it an intentional choice to have the two minor key Mozart piano concertos right next to each other on the program?
I think
in different weeks.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of things that, you know, where we build the program around, and of course with the Bruckner's Six and Mozart's Requiem, we thought to build more concertos around that. And of course, with these absolutely genius pianists. And I have already played with Mitsuko before, but it's I'm looking so much forward to play again. And she's, of course, as you said, I mean, when she plays, it feels like Mozart is just next to her, and, you know. And it's going to be my first time with Radu Lupu, and I'm looking forward, because it's also so interesting. She told me, we had a rehearsal meeting with Mitsuko, and she told Radu, yes, she really loves him, and you know, it was just so great to hear that colleagues are saying yes, he's so great, you know. He's very different, but I'm looking forward to play with both of them. And of course, from that sense, of course, we agreed to the repertoire which they would want to do, and they knew what is also in the program, so it kind of worked out that way. And of course, the minor, and well, from one hand, it's of course Mozart Requiem. It's what a dramatic piece, of course, and when we hear the word Requiem, we are always very dramatized, and also Bruckner, it's also one of his pieces, one of the symphonies which is not always been as clearly understood as other, or I would say as unclearly understood, because none of them are really clearly understandable, because they're so unique and so universal. So it's very difficult to say to come to the point. To I think it's for many musicians or conductors to say, yes, I understand. Really, I know what Bruckner means, and I really understand. I think it's probably not meant to be like that as well. I mean, I love Bruckner's music, and I'm having a fantastic journey into his music and his personality, and I love it. And and of course, the combination with these amazing artists, pianists, and another amazing composer, Mozart, of course, somehow made the program. Yeah, and of course, Mitsuko and D minor. This, as she says, and I think I agree as well. It's so much Don Giovanni. It's so much opera. I mean, everything in Mozart. I think it comes really very connected to opera, and there is this dramatic aspect, and in the same time, then it's also the humor, which is at the end. It's very interesting. I think it's drama jocosa, so the concerto, and I think Bruckner himself is always dramatic in at some points, and of course in the Sixth Symphony there is a moment where darker in the second movement there's even Trauermarsch feeling, but he always finds a way to glorify the God or to have a solution for things. And he doesn't bring, I mean, we feel and we know that, let's say, Bruckner has a lot of inner troubles and worries, and but he is never complaining in his music about himself. That's very, which would be, you know, very, very normal. Very often composers, of course, reflect on, for example, Mahler. I mean, you of course, he's a genius composer, but he talks about his life, and of course, life what's around. But it's, you always connect it with Mahler and he, what he feels at that time. But with Bruckner, I think it's different. He's too shy to talk about himself, or he's maybe that's why his symphony is such a miracle, and it's such a question mark that he doesn't want to expose himself as well in a certain way. And anyway, I think this is next, you know, to this gigantic genius. I think work of Bruckner, the sixth symphony. And absolutely genius playing of Mitsuko in D minor concerto, and then Radulupu in a C minor.
Tell me though, when you talk about the two artists who are playing Mozart piano concertos, the orchestral parts for those are not complicated in the sense of really technically demanding for every player, but they have to interact with each soloist very seamlessly. Do you, when you're conducting with different artists doing, especially Mozart piano concertos, how much do you have to change what you're asking of the orchestra to match a particular artist? Or does Mozart's writing kind of always work no matter what the soloist is doing?
I think it's always you play and it's... And of course, particularly with Mozart, you think that you feel like it's just composing now, and it's just easy. It's very easily done, and it's very easy to play, and it's very easy to compose. You have an illusion.
Yeah.
But that's only illusion. I think the reality, as you know, it's actually that it's not so easy to play anything, but also Mozart. And I personally think it always requires from orchestra, from conductor, from the soloist, a chamber music element, which is open ears, and I meet with the soloist before, and we talk through, and then I know what the direction soloist wants to go, and then I think it through, and of course then comes the orchestra, and we play together, and then of course it's either the balances or some characters or dynamics, and some soloists are more fragile. They prefer very, very intimate. And some maybe like more dramatic, and this all happens in the rehearsal, and then we feel, and I think the most important, if we are open to be flexible and having fun making music and thinking in the chamber music terms, that's the way I think these great artists do, and this is what I enjoy doing. And this is what orchestra has also got used to do. I think they are so great accompanying. But there are moments, again, from when the orchestra needs to be... Maybe it's not so much in these concertos, but when there's a lot of, particularly, you know, the woodwind parts are quite challenging and very solistic. So, but even in these concertos, there is still the moment of solo as well. And I think this is, as they would say, that everyone knows what happens in the family. The last double bass knows what the left leg of the pianist is doing. You know, so it's
right.
This is more fun to make music. You know,
yeah.
So I think that's kind of a sharing and having fun but being personally dedicated to the composer.
That's Andras Nelsons from a much longer conversation about the series of Boston Symphony concerts he's conducting to wrap up this season. And again, you'll hear more about those concerts in the coming episodes of The Answered Question. Next weekend, on April 21st and 23rd, Boston Baroque is performing Handel's Giulio Cesare, led, as always, by Martin Perlman. And this Sunday, the 16th, at 7 p.m., Chris Voss brings you another Handel opera, Agrippina, on WCRB in concert with Boston Baroque, in a performance from 2015.
My colleague Alan McClellan talked with Martin Perlman, and he began by asking about the place of Handel's operas in the repertoire of Boston Baroque.
Yeah, well, we have done a number of Handel operas. This is the earliest one we've done, but it's, of course, one of Handel's earliest. We did do it once before, some years ago, and it's just such a wonderful piece, so we had to do it again.
I understand when it was first performed, there was such excitement about this young Handel, amazing fellow, and in Venice, wasn't it?
Yes, actually, it was his first major public triumph. He was 24 years old. He had been in Italy for a couple of years, and he was getting performed a lot. He was writing an awful lot of music, but it was being performed mostly in private salons or palaces, but not as public performances. But this was just a huge triumph. It made him famous throughout Europe, really, and affected the rest of his career.
It's a classical plot, and it reminds me a lot of Monteverdi's Papea, there's some relation between those two operas in terms of the plots.
Yeah, well, this is sort of a prequel, if you will. It's got some of the same characters. The Monteverdi, of course, is about the Emperor Nero and Poppea, his mistress, whom he later married. And this is before they were together. The characters, except for one semi-comic character, the characters are all historical characters. But the story itself isn't really historical. I mean, we don't know that some of these crazy things happen. They make good opera.
Of them are kind of comical, too.
Yeah. Which often doesn't happen in Handel operas. There are a few places in other later ones, but normally not. No, this has to do with, well, it is Nero, but here Nero is very young. And his mother, Agrippina, who is the title character, of course, is going through all kinds of machinations to get him on the throne. She's married to Claudius, who is the emperor. And in the beginning, Claudius is presumed dead in an accident at sea. It turns out he's not, and that interrupts all her plans. But and then it just leads to a series of complicated love triangles or squares, even. It's a lot of people involved, three different people in love with Poppea. That all gets finally sorted out, and Nero is appointed the successor to Claudius. Now, of course, it ends happily, but of course, we know all of them met horrible deaths in actual reality. So it's almost a comical effect in the end, because they end with a joyous chorus about Rome and about how everything's worked out. But we know that's not how these characters actually did end up.
Tell me about the cast you have. Soprano Susanna Phillips.
Yeah.
It was so wonderful to get
she
her from
wonderful.
From the Metropolitan Opera and many other places.
Yeah, she's a spectacular star, and she's, of course, singing the title role. And Amanda Forsyth, who performs with us a great deal, but performs all over Europe and everywhere now, sang the role of Poppea. And then Nero is a countertenor, David Hanson. And then we have cast from all over. Marie Lenormand is a wonderful French singer who sang the role of Otto or Ottone, who is ended up as the husband of Poppea. And that role was actually written originally for a woman, even though it's a male role.
Yeah, it's
a lot
fascinating.
Of switching.
Because we have Nero played by a man, but singing in a register that is
very high.
Sounds very, very high.
And, That's right. And Kevin Days, wonderful bass baritone, who sings with us often. It was Claudius, the emperor. Douglas Williams sang Pallas, Christa River. And Mark McSweeney also sang.
And those singers from around here and doing great things.
Yeah.
Can you take me through the beginning of Act One? How does it all begin?
Well, it begins with the reports that Claudius, the emperor, was drowned at sea on his way back with his army from a campaign. And so that sets in motion right away the plots of Agrippina to get her son on the throne. And she makes him go out in the crowd and be very ingratiating with people and, you know, kind of buy their votes, basically. And as he's about to be not literally crowned at that moment, but just proclaimed the next emperor. The report comes in that Claudius actually was not drowned. He was saved. And he's headed towards the city. And that throws off her plans, but she's very resourceful, and she's always switching plans. And she knows that her husband, Claudius, is in love with Poppaea. So is Ottone, who Claudius wants as his successor. And so she starts playing them off against each other and spreading rumors about them. Basically, and so she convinces Claudius to refuse to make Ottone the next emperor. That's what she wants, so that Nero will be the emperor. So that's Act One, all of that.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And then in Act Two, the plot thickens more.
Yes, as usual. Here, Ottone does come to Claudius in this public arena, and when Claudius is being welcomed back, proud of the fact that he's been appointed the next emperor, and then Claudius's mind on this subject has been poisoned by Agrippina, denounces him as a traitor and says, no, I'm not going to do this. And so that's a shock. And then everybody gradually rejects Ottone, and he's left alone. And Poppaea, who really does love him, kind of doubts all of this. So they begin to come back from this.
So they're coming back from the rejection.
Yeah. Yes. So Agrippina is still trying to get Claudius involved in plots against various people and using various people to further her plans. But her goal is always to get Nero put on the throne. Very ironic, because we know historically in the end that Nero, once he was on the throne, had his mother killed for being too conniving. And in fact, Handel wrote an Agrippina cantata in which she is singing by herself and just realizing that she is going to be put to death gradually, you know, that they're after her and something's going to happen. So this is, who knows?
So then in Act Three, it all comes around.
Right. And there's a very comical scene where Poppaea has three different lovers in her rooms at the same time, but two of them are hiding
under the bed.
Exactly. And then when Claudius comes in, she proves to him that Nero is actually courting her, and when he is trying to court her himself, and it's very complicated. But they finally sort it out. The emperor does forgive various people, and he wants to make Ottone the emperor again, but Ottone, because he wouldn't be able to marry Poppaea, refuses, and Claudius forgives him and appoints Nero the emperor, which, of course, we know did happen.
So that's the easy solution for
the opera.
That's
the end. Yeah.
Excellent.
In the super titles, during the final happy chorus, we did sort of put asides in the super titles about what happened to each of these characters. They all met horrible ends. And Ottone eventually did become an emperor, but didn't last. He committed suicide after a couple months as emperor. So everybody had their turn here, but nobody survived.
They all died an ugly death, even though the opera doesn't end that way.
No, the opera ends at a high point.
You have Boston Baroque has an ingenious way of presenting these operas on the stage at Jordan Hall to give just enough of the action and just enough of the scene to take the audience's imagination away.
Right.
How has this transpired over all these different productions?
Well, I've always been interested in finding a way. Well, first of all, we're not ultimately an opera company that's committed to sets and the full production, but I've always wanted to focus a little more on the music and finding a way not to hide the orchestra down in a pit, but when I put them in the middle of the stage and acting all around them, sometimes behind as well as on the sides and in front, then the orchestra becomes, in a sense, players in the drama. You see all the activity of the violins, you know, furiously bowing in excited moments, and that becomes part of the action. And so I like that approach. And, of course, you know, we can easily focus on the drama and the singers because they're in costume and they're in front.
And lighting helps too.
Lighting, yeah. We've been able to add more elements as we've grown this, and you know, people have come to love it, and I like doing it that way.
What was Handel's secret that he discovered this early in his career about how to capture an audience? I mean, he had just this ingenious kind of way of you know, of really making an experience for people.
Yeah, I think that's what makes Handel stand out among his contemporaries. Of course, he was writing beautiful arias and brilliant music, and you know, that's a given. But beyond all that, I think he had a sense of drama, where you could take a character, as Mozart could, and just make them real, make the music tell us even more about this person. And so it became very much a human drama, even if the characters were mythological or, in this case, you know, historical from ancient times. They become very real. What's fascinating about this opera in that respect is that very little of it was original for this opera. Handel had a it's well known, he had a habit of borrowing music sometimes from other composers, and often from himself or earlier music. And he had written over 100 cantatas by this point, even though he's very young, when he was in Italy, and extraordinary output, plus other music as well. And he did borrow some of that for some of these arias. In fact, there are only about 5 or 6 numbers in this that don't have any connection to other music, which is extraordinary if you think about it. But he somehow manages to take that music and transform it, rework it completely in some cases, and in some cases really just borrow, but make it fit the character. He doesn't just stick it in. And so no matter what he's doing, there's this magic, I don't know, Midas touch that he has, where the music becomes something that furthers this character. Even if its origins were elsewhere, he knows how to pick the right thing, and then he knows how to adapt that music. It's an extraordinary gift, and it's a gift to all of us.
Absolutely. It's a great gift to have Boston Baroque's performance of it. Martin Perlman, thank you so much for coming in, and we'll look forward to Agrippina.
Thank you.
That's Martin Perlman, the founder and conductor of Boston Baroque, with WCRB's Alan McClellan. Again, you'll hear Handel's Agrippina this Sunday at 7 p.m. on WCRB in concert with Boston Baroque. And check our website next week to hear it on demand. And that's it for the answered question this week. You can subscribe to TAQ at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. And you'll also find us on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to Andres Nelsons and Martin Perlman, as well as the staffs of the Boston Symphony and Boston Baroque for making these conversations possible. Thanks also to Alan McClellan. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.